Hello, and welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Yarmush, and this is our second episode in our series with Dr. Jesse Boehm, CSO of the Breakthrough Cancer Foundation. If you haven't yet listened to the first, I recommend it for both the context and because it's simply fascinating. He's dedicated the entirety of his career to cancer research. Already invested in this space, he doubled down after a personal connection was discovered. And discussion begins there before focusing on the balance between the now and the future, the finances and the reputation, and, of course, the goal above all else. Welcome back, Jesse. Appreciate you coming to us again. How are you doing today?
It's great to be back, David. Nice speaking with you again.
Normally, I would ask you something about a moment in your life or your career that led to your focus being reorganized or shuffled. But it sounds like you've been in cancer from the beginning. You mentioned when you were in graduate school and undergraduate. So was there something that made this all just come together that brought you to look at cancer from day one?
Yeah, I think I was always excited about translational research. I was undergraduate at MIT. I liked thinking about engineering solutions to kind of complicated biological problems, and human disease and cancer in particular was one such problem. I think when I joined Harvard Medical School and Dana-Farber for my graduate work, I think I was able to really, pursue that passion. There was just so much opportunity to explore cancer in the lab. I kind of, dove right in. But I think for me, it felt like a puzzle I was trying to solve, almost like a Rubik's Cube, like an intellectual puzzle. I think at the Dana-Farber, like for many of your listeners who kind of work at cancer institutions, I think there's a strong benefit in kind of riding up the elevator each day with cancer patients, because you spend time in the lab working with cells or working with mice, but every morning and often every evening, you're kind of showing up at work side by side with patients that are showing up to the clinic, and you're leaving each day, facing and smiling in the elevator with patients that have, just completed chemotherapy or something like that. And so it's kind of impossible. And I sort of learned that what I was doing wasn't just a puzzle solving academic exercise, but actually was quite, relevant for patients. And I think that was a really good thing, because it sort of stimulated and sustained the energy and kind of the creativity. I think midway through grad school, what really was pivotal for me was actually my wife's diagnosis with a head and neck cancer, which kind of came from left field. Actually, we had been traveling at a cancer conference, and she realized that something was up, and soon got diagnosed. And since she had no risk factors and was never a drinker or smoker or anything like that, it kind of seemed like it came out of the blue. And I think it turned us from kind of carefree 23-year-olds or 24-year-olds to kind of thinking about, actually, this is a clear and present danger for her, for this moment in time. And not only was it not an academic exercise for humanity, but it wasn't really an academic exercise for us. And so, 15 years later, I think she's in a better place. But for us, it really put a pin on making the best of the time that you have and really working with great urgency. So I think I was always collaborative, but it pushed me to be even more collaborative, because why slow down if the fastest path to benefit patients like my wife was to be collaborative? Why hold data back when if the right thing to do was to give all your data away because that patient in the clinic was suffering, that was the right thing to do. So it sort of stimulated for me and for her kind of an urgency of the moment that had, personal outcomes in terms of, having a family and, making good decisions professionally quite quickly. But it also, again, as I said before, accentuated a professional commitment to not just do what other people were doing and not just try to be territorial about my own science, but to try to put patients first, to try to solve the real problems, because you never know when you or your spouse or your child or your parent is going to be the next patient. And you don't want to look back and say, oh, I wish there was more I could have done. I wish I could have worked faster. I wish I could have worked harder. So for me, it really accentuated something that I think was deep-seated, that one had to work with passion and urgency. And I was fortunate, as I mentioned in the last episode, to then evolve from Dana-Farber. It was around the time the Broad Institute was getting formed. I actually had the thought of, building a new organization that had the power of industry and the financing of mm-hmm. industry, but was really in the nonprofit world and the resourcing available to nonprofits. But it actually wasn't needed because at the time the Broad was just getting formed. My mentor, Bill Hahn, was one of the founding members of the cancer program. And he said, you know what, one of the best ways of following this passion would be to help grow the Broad's cancer program. And I was fortunate then to do that for 15 years. And then after that, I've continued to pursue that at this new organization called Breakthrough Cancer. So I've always tried to, especially after my wife's diagnosis, kind of follow the signpost, the northern light of what's needed, what's going to solve the problem, kind of without regard to what it means for me professionally, without regard for what risks that involves taking. And I think when I've spoken with other researchers that themselves have been diagnosed with cancer or whom have had family members diagnosed with cancer, it often is an inflection point in which they kind of stop caring about the standard things and they start caring about just kind of doing the right things. And it's my hope that your listeners here might think for themselves about, is there something that they could do prior to being confronted with that sort of horrible sort of moment? Could they be living and breathing that urgency every day without that? And I think more and more cancer researchers, especially at the beginnings of their careers, and especially those that interact with patients, do feel that urgency. But for many of us, it seems a bit abstract, especially if it's further and further away. But after that, it didn't anymore for me.
I think it's in some ways complicated, and there might be a little bit of just my own projection here. But obviously, it's easy to assume that a 20-something scientist has a bit of an ego about them and a vanity. They want to be the one that is solving the world's problems and get the credit for it. And I'm sure many of us are like that. Maybe not all of us, maybe not even a lot of us, but there's enough, right? There's a reputation, there's a stereotype among scientists for that. But on the other hand, your reputation matters in science. It matters when you're seeking grant funding. It matters when you're trying to get an article published in a journal. And there's a balance that needs to be struck there. And so I understand why you're describing this inflection point, right? Like it makes sense that suddenly that doesn't matter. Full steam ahead. Let's do whatever can be done. But on the flip side, prior to that inflection, there's always the, well, if I maintain this now, 5 years down the line, I'll be able to secure more funding and get more better stuff done, right? Like how does, yeah, I'm sure I'm not the first one to describe that to you. How did the inflection point affect that calculus?
That's right. It's a real and complicated calculation that each researcher makes about how generous and how, where does the risk come from? Does the risk come from being more generous and more open? Is that greater risk because people will steal your stuff and steal your ideas? Or is there greater risk to being territorial and holding things back? Being protectionist might solve one set of problems, but it insulates one from great ideas and great teams. And it often leads to, I've observed, a much higher risk. And so it's not as if either approach, I think, David, is high or low risk. It's just balancing those two types of risks. I think in my experience, when one gives data away freely, when one shares ideas freely, one actually gets to be on twice as many papers, and one actually gets to be invited to twice as many meetings. And when people review your grants, you're twice as more likely to be known and appreciated because you've just been so present in so many things. So it's not to say that it's been without risk, but I've seen far greater risks through the other axis. The fear of being scooped or something being stolen, when that produces a protectionist sort of attitude, then leads to competition. Because instead of sharing, you're competing. And maybe you'll win the race, maybe you won't win the race, but now you're in a race. Instead of just working together, now you're racing with your colleagues. And a lot of the times you're going to lose that race. And if, even though what it felt safer, it's actually produced a much higher risk because now you're second or third instead of just working together and publishing several papers all at once. And so even though, yes, I am an idealist about this point, I do recognize the reality. Early on in one's career, people are vulnerable. And one really requires great care and great thought in terms of how one makes these decisions. Team science, when one is a postdoc, is a complicated kind of endeavor. Postdocs and graduate students need to learn how to be a scientist. They need to establish a track record of excellence. They need to begin to make a name for themselves. And yes, I will say that they need to learn how to collaborate, but that's probably a third tier priority after those others. When one is growing their lab, one needs to secure funding and you know, demonstrate kind of productivity. But then by the time one hits kind of mid-career and is a little bit more confident, if one hasn't learned how to collaborate and how to work together, you start to, I think, move in often the wrong direction. And so I think the mid-career scientists that have really learned and loved collaboration early on then end up reaching a next level of productivity. I'm fortunate to work with people within the larger Breakthrough Cancer Network that kind of after 10 years of running their lab, they said, is this all there is? You know, should I just kind of leave academia, or, you know, what else can I do? And now they're kind of on point across what we call team labs, which is a virtual shared community of 20 PIs and, you know, 80 people across many cancer centers. And they're kind of leading that thing. And that's kind of a natural extension of their lab. It's more diffuse, it's more complicated, but they're getting a lot of joy and passion from growing and supporting a much broader community, even outside of their own executional control. And I think that's a very hopeful, you know, professional path. And folks are reporting that these types of team lab-based projects are among the more exciting things they've ever done professionally, because it's giving them a chance to pursue that passion. So I've always encouraged people to pursue the field as they think it's going to be 10 years from now. If you focus on where the field is, by the time you get there, the field will have evolved. I think the field is becoming more collaborative. The types of projects are becoming more interdisciplinary. And if you grow your professional skills to anticipate that kind of 2033, you know, kind of future, you're going to be best prepared for what the field looks like then. And so that's the word of encouragement I would give to junior scientists. I would be careful, but I would definitely try to learn these collaborative skills and exercise that muscle, you know, early on.
Yeah, it sounds like Breakthrough Cancer is, you're talking about the mid-career, the PIs and so forth that are running the labs, but they've got early career people beneath them, right? Or working with them. So they are now being exposed to that in real time. I imagine that serves as an excellent training for exactly what you're talking about. What is 2033 going to look like? Because they're going to be the ones running it by then.
Exactly. And I know it sounds kind of overly idealistic and simplistic, but the system that we're in for cancer and for biomedicine is really just like 90 years old. It was like created by people. It was created by, you know, earlier generations coming out of World War II. And this idea that you just kind of do science independently and kind of compete with each other for limited grant funding, that was like created by a bunch of people. And so I think the system for cancer needs to change. And I think it's just much more exciting to be part, to be a change agent within that system, so that a generation from now, the system will look different, as opposed to just assuming there is a way that things have to be done. It's always been that way. And thou shalt, you know, behave a certain way. I think there's, well, while there's a reality to that, like today, I think 5 or 10 years from now, this is increasingly changing. And so the risk is, I think, actually higher in pursuing a career the standard way than it is in trying to do things a little bit differently. I think certain organizations, certain cancer centers, certain nonprofits, certain drug companies are more forward-looking in terms of these new structural explorations, and certain ones are more, you know, a little bit behind the eight ball. And so thinking about one's own view and one's own risk level, and then choosing an environment and an organization and helping to grow environments and organization that are kind of a good match for the way you're thinking about your career, I think is the right approach, as opposed to thinking, you know, there's a one size fits all solution, you know, to being a cancer scientist.
What's the sense of being a scientist if you're not an idealist?
That's the case. You know, well, if I 80 years from now, I don't know, 60 years from now or whatever, you know, if the end of my life, I don't want to look back and, you know, say I did a lot of, you know, Petri dish experiments. I want to look back and say that, you know, I did something profound. I had a profound delta on the system or on research or on discovery. and something is different because of my involvement in it. And I think to do that, you have to take a certain number of risks. I think if what I did is look back and say, yeah, I published a whole bunch of great Cell papers, I don't think that would be satisfactory. I had this other interesting experience during the pandemic of working to support COVID testing in public schools. My wife's a public school teacher. I'm a scientist. We kind of work together across about 20 Massachusetts public school districts to talk about, you know, ensuring that the departments understood how to get COVID testing accessible across schools. And at the end of that experience, I wrote a piece in Cell, kind of a personal reflection on, what it means to be a scientist in the modern moment and what our communities actually expect from us. And at the end of that article, I said, and it was published in Cell. At the end of the article, I wrote at the end, I said, if all we do is, if the world needs us to do much more than publish Cell papers, you know, if I've learned anything, you know, that it's that. And so I do believe in that. I think science and public policy at that interface, that's where scientists are needed. Scientists and education at that interface, that's where scientists are needed. And even in the lab, scientists pursuing new approaches and new structures, I think that is a big part of where scientists are needed now.
100% agreed, for starters. I was going to shift gears, but I couldn't let that go. So we were talking about where your drive came from, right? You know, the inflection points. Has there been a point, and I'll be shocked if you say no, has there been a point where you feel like you've hit I have succeeded at least in part at my dream? You know, you will on this inevitable deathbed look back and say, I at least contributed something.
Well, I've certainly contributed something. I think it's still too early to know the outcome of that something. I've always thought of myself, at least scientifically, as a bit of a, you know, concept entrepreneur. Not an entrepreneur yet in the sense of, you know, growing companies and starting businesses, but a sense that there's something complicated out there that doesn't yet exist. And that whether it's new technology in the lab or a new structural concept, and that if only I can wrap my hands around it and grow a team to kind of think about that, if I could do that, then I could de-risk that concept. Maybe it'll fail, but maybe it'll succeed. But I could reduce it to practice and de-risk it and show other people sort of how to do it. And so over the years, that's how my lab have tried to run, you know, could you turn any human tumor into an organoid model? We grew a cancer cell line factory, and 4,000 samples later, we said, yeah, you know, that's not every sample, but, you know, 40% of samples, you know, we can do that. And can we grow an international partnership to do that? And yeah, working with a bunch of organizations, we did that. Can you engineer cancer variants using CRISPR and figure out what variants of unknown function actually do? Did a set of studies and we showed that, okay, that was possible. Now we're doing this project, the single cell, we call it the biosensor project, you know, growing tumor cells for 1 week and perturbing them and using high content morphology and machine learning to figure out like what cell is which and how does it respond to drugs. Could you build a functional genomics kind of diagnostic approach and have that be useful for tumors? And eventually, hopefully, we'll show that that's possible. And then with breakthrough cancer, this kind of structural reform. So I think I've tried to go through one by one and kind of de-risk these concepts. I think the proof will be in the pudding, David, of whether after these things have been de-risked, that like lots of people then, you know, go and take them up. And I think there's some evidence of that, but some of these things are still too new. But, you know, I'm going to keep trying because I think the field needs some idealists. And it's not just me. I think it's exciting to see lots of other people going down this path as well. And people, I think, tend to be more passionate and idealistic, again, especially after, you know, personal experience with the disease or a personal confrontation, you know, with a big challenge or their own mortality or something like that.
Oh, you certainly set the stage.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll take, cancer's not yet cured, so I guess we failed so far. But it's exciting to see where things are. I'm quite a bit more optimistic about the next 10 or 20 years than I think I would have been, you know, in the 1980s or 1990s, because you can see the revolution now as it's unfolding. You can see that instead of this being a mysterious entity, it's we kind of know what cancers are. Instead of these different ways of, you know, drugging cancers and stimulating immunity being kind of random ideas, we're seeing successes and we're starting to combine them. And I think these broad experiments at stimulating collaboration are a really key piece of the puzzle, because scientists that want to do something bigger than their own lab can stay within academia, can stay within the nonprofit world, and or can leave and go into industry. But in any of those environments, you can begin to work more and more collaboratively. So I think I'm hopeful about the system and about the next 10 or 20 years. And I think this is the moment. I think we can do, you know, 10 or 20 years worth of work or in a shorter period of time, certainly do the next 20 years worth of, the next 50 years worth of work in 20 years if we work together. So I think cancer by 2050 is going to look just fundamentally different than cancer looks today.
Well, Jesse, I appreciate both your time once again, and also this clear lead into what our next episode is going to be. So just thank you. And for everyone listening, come in next time and we'll talk about the future of cancer research.
I can't wait. Thanks, David, for having me back. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
The serendipity of getting involved with the Broad Institute from its beginnings, coupled with the synchronicity of Dr. Boehm's wife's diagnosis, helped set him on track for a storied career in cancer research. He supported one of Breakthrough Cancer's initiatives to make cancer research less risky for smaller institutions with the aim of producing more sincere collaboration and advancing the field faster, the so-called democratization of research. Stay with us for the next episode when Jesse describes his hopes for the next 20 or so years.